about a preacher who was to preach on the subject of honesty and integrity. And so he told everyone in the morning service to read Joshua chapter 25. And the next Sunday he came, and or the evening when he came to the evening worship, he said, "Okay, how many have read it?" And half of the church raised their hands. He said, "Great. Now you're the ones I want to talk to. Joshua has only 24 chapters. I'm especially concerned about you tonight. The subject of honesty and integrity." And it is true that sometimes we answer too quickly, think too quickly, not soberly enough, not seriously enough about a particular decision we're about to make, or about a question that's being asked. We're too flippant. Maybe we've been known to exaggerate, not tell the truth completely. And we must not, people, you know, minimize the importance of faithfulness in the sense that we talked about it this morning, trustworthiness, integrity, honesty, all those things we discussed this morning. There just isn't a better example in all the Bible than Joseph. Joseph, a man of integrity. Daryl informed me I could preach this sermon tonight. It was probably his favorite Bible character. So we'll talk about his favorite character tonight. And Joseph was a man of integrity, man of faithfulness. He was full of faith. And we'll see as we go through this story in our attempts to continue to try to tell a story about those things and those characters involving so many of the Old Testament individuals to whom Paul was pointing back to when he said, "These things which were written aforetime were written for your learning." And that they might give you what? Hope. Because we learn a lot about these characters. Not just the good stuff. We get their warts too. God tells us those things and gives us those things for a reason. I mean, I've said it, I'll say it again. It's nice for us to be able to read about some of these characters and know that they weren't mistake-free. I'd be in trouble, wouldn't I? If that weren't the case. So would you. So, you know, we can learn about the mistakes they make. Not that those were good, not that they're good when I make them. But that we can learn from them that, you know, with all that, and because of the merciful God we serve, there are provisions made when you can do something as grave and horrible as David did. You can still be called a man after God's own heart. Thank God we serve a God like that. But imagine having your family beat on you. Some of you may feel like you've been beaten on. I've been beaten on by my grandkids for 6 straight days. But imagine having your family beat on you and throw you into a pit and leave you to die. And then at the older brother's insistence, when they come back, decision is made that they won't kill you, but instead they'll sell you off as a slave to a Midianite caravan. And they send this scared teenage boy, see yourself as that boy, probably 16, 17 years old. And they send him off to a land where he knew nobody, where a language was spoken that he didn't understand, knew not a soul, understood not a word. Scared, wondering why he'd been betrayed by his family, the people he thought who loved him. But yet we read about Joseph and we see in him this young man who ends up being accused of a crime he did not commit to complicate his life further. Thrown into a dungeon, instead of doing what a good many of us would do and going to a pity party, he ends up essentially becoming the warden of the place, taking care of the jail. And such was the good that he did in the dream telling that occurred there and what he was able to translate as it related to those dreams, that as he handled these things, he ended up raising himself or rising to such a level he was known to have been second in all the land, the governor for sure. Joseph's an amazing story. In Joseph, we read about how to handle prosperity. In Joseph, we read about how to handle adversity. In Joseph, we read about how to handle resentment, or how to be a person who's able to deal with not being resentful, about forgiveness. And Joseph is a worthwhile character, I think, for us to discuss. The name Joseph means he will add or add to me or increaser. Joseph was the 11th son of Jacob and the first of Rachel's. Benjamin, of course, being the last, and Rachel would die in giving birth to Benjamin. And she called his name Joseph and said, "The Lord shall add to me another son." Genesis 30 and verse 24. Names were pretty meaningful during this time, as I think all of us understand and know. He's listed, as was read in Hebrews chapter 11, as one of the faithful. And what's really said about him is kind of interesting, as it's talking about Joseph. So much could have been discussed, but what's discussed is his death. By faith, Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. And he dies at 110 years old. You can see Genesis 50, verses 24 through 25. What we want to do tonight is to break up Joseph's life into three different segments, to kind of look at some of the activities that he had and to tell the story about Joseph and to try to help us understand who he was. The first is his birth to 17 years. Before I get into that, let me talk about his daddy a little bit, Jacob. Jacob, the name Jacob, means he that supplanteth or follows after. Literally, a chiseler or deceiver. Any question about where that name may have come from? Now, I often wonder about whether or not they, in retrospect, came back and added definitions to these names. It's just hard for me to imagine that a mother and a father would name their child a chiseler, you know. So I would say that there's something to that. In some cases, you know, that there's some retrospective work done as it relates to some of these names. But anyway, Jacob was both good and bad, I think. He didn't have the faith of Abraham or the purity of Joseph. He was inconsistent with his life, for sure. He learned deception early, didn't he? In large part because of his mother. And he learned partiality from his mother. Seems to me that when you read about these characters, you often see the son and the father. Have you noticed that? So you see some of those characteristics, but not so much with Joseph. Joseph, you see, is able to take the good from Jacob and discard the bad, which kind of goes to the point that, like Ezekiel would say, the son does not bear the iniquity of the father, neither the father the iniquity of the son. Our children don't have to be like us. They can be. They can choose to do that. But it's no more absolute to train up a child the way he should go, and when he was old, he will not depart from it. He will not forget it. It's no more absolute that that is so than a person who's not a Christian would have to stay in that condition or situation and never know the truth because he was raised by a parent that wasn't a Christian, a child of God. Children are free to choose. I think we all get that and understand it. Joseph chose to be good in spite of all the things went wrong in his life. But Jacob had his issues for sure. He refers to Joseph as the son of his old age. And that certainly was true because Jacob was well into years whenever Joseph was born. His deception of Esau, of course his mother's idea, did not speak well necessarily for Jacob's integrity. He played along for sure. Jacob, I think, probably was known, and most commentators would refer to him as being a passive individual when little emotion was due. For example, the plan not just to deceive Esau, but also when Dinah, his daughter, was raped by Shechem, you might remember, in Genesis chapter 34. Most fathers would not have taken something like that very well. he seemed to be pretty accepting, if you will, of that particular situation when being a little more passionate and vocal may have been what was due. Jacob was not vocal when Reuben, his oldest son, had sexual relations with Bilhah, the mother of two of his half-brothers, Genesis chapter 35 and verse 22. And the most he does is refers to his oldest son as uncontrolled as water. I've always found that interesting. Genesis 49, verses 3 through 4. And I could go on about it, but the lesson's not really about Jacob. But it is to help us to understand that fathers do have influence on their children, but children can, on their own, decide to be good no matter what decisions, poor decisions, their parents may choose to make. And so each one of us are responsible for ourselves and what choices we're actually going to make. So here we are, first of three different segments that we're going to talk about, the birth to 17 years. And I think most of us are familiar with Joseph's story, but my job in all this is to try to make sure I tell the story so that some who are not familiar with it will at least hear the story. And some of these kids, children in here, could do a better job in telling the story of Joseph than I can. Joseph's family, who was in transition, and in a situation that, as it relates to their family, raised Joseph up as a favorite son, if you will. In fact, his father made him a coat, a tunic, that was probably longer than sometimes it's seen drawn, that had many colors in it. We call it the coat of many colors. That's how it's referred to. And certainly it was a coat that had multi colors, a tunic, if you will. And it probably was sleeved. Most think extended to the ankles. You can read about that from Genesis 37 and verse 3. And a tunic of this nature was not easy to do. It was a very difficult process in trying to make one of these things. And obviously the brothers could see the work that Jacob was going through in trying to make this special gift or prize and give it to his son, Joseph. It pleased Joseph, I'm sure, and probably his father, Jacob, and maybe even his mother, but his brothers were extremely jealous over what was being done. They didn't like the idea that they were out doing all the grunt work while the father was home, making a tunic for his son and giving him the better jobs, so to speak. The jealous resentment of these brothers burned with them until the Bible says they hated him and could not speak peaceably with him in chapter 37 and verse 4. One translator says they could not speak on friendly terms with him. That's sad that an environment with our brothers and sisters could turn that way, but it certainly does happen from time to time. Try to imagine the resentment that was building up and even the mounting pressure within that home. It was a powder keg ready to explode. As these brothers talked to themselves in envy and in jealousy about this boy who was preferred by their parents. Adding insult to injury, Joseph was a dreamer. And so he begins to dream, and in his dreams he begins telling his brothers about these dreams and about how his wheat or sheaves, his collection of wheat, was such that their 11 sheaves were actually going to bow down to his, and that the 11 stars, and not just the 11 stars that they represented and who they were going to also bow down to him, but also the sun and the moon, the mother and the father, would bow down before him. And again, the envy and the rage, the resentment begin and continue to build until it finally blew. And not much was done by Jacob really to defuse the situation other than on one occasion he asked in chapter 37 verse 10, what is this that you're thinking about as it relates to these dreams? But no real discipline took place like I think probably should have in this environment situation. Certainly a lesson to be learned for any parents, to be very, very careful about showing bias or prejudice toward one of your children, and be very careful in how you handle that. So we see Joseph in this situation. And then in the second period of his life, Genesis 37 in verse what is that? 37:2, verse 41 through 46. My bifocals just went for a minute. So here Joseph, we find, reaches young manhood. It seems as though his life has become out of control. And as I say here, enslavement, betrayal, unfair accusations and treatment, and imprisonment are his plight. And we know that, you know, as Joseph is, it seems like having God's favor shown upon him as he's delivered to this leader's house, Potiphar, and in that home is giving free rein to the house to do with whatever he chose to do. And the Bible tells us that he was a good-looking guy. And Potiphar's wife noticed that. And in that observation, tried to seduce him. And Joseph in chapter 39 and verse 9 kind of becomes, 10, kind of becomes the poster boy of how to handle this kind of situation for us men. Because he says, as he flees from Potiphar's wife, how then can I do this wickedness and sin against God? It's bad enough, he says, to sin against my master, Potiphar. But even bigger and better than that, I've got to run from this situation. How can I sin against my God? So it should be for each one of us, each man, each woman for that, as relates to that as well, that we need to be very careful about letting our guard down instead to flee from those situations, understanding that if we don't do that and don't run from those situations in which we are being seduced, that we'll not just sin against that particular person or against other people, but we'll sin more importantly against God. And that's something that we need to be careful about, something we wouldn't want to do, and Joseph didn't want to do. So as the boys have deceived their father into thinking that Joseph is dead, and they've ravished a beast and painted his coat with blood and took that report back to the father, led him to believe that Joseph was gone. Then Potiphar's wife, as Joseph is delivered into Egypt in this situation, Potiphar's wife seduces Joseph day by day, is what it says in chapter 39 and verse 10, but he refuses to give in. And you would think that Potiphar would have had, if Joseph were guilty of this, or even if he had a notion that he was guilty of this, if Potiphar would have done what he had the right to do and the privilege to do, he would have killed Joseph. I mean, he would have hung him, whatever it is he would do during this period of time to a violator of this choice. One wonders then that if one or two things happened here, that Potiphar really knew the heart of Joseph and the heart of his wife. And maybe that's the reason why he made his distinction. More than likely, it's just more the fact, as we look back at the story, that God's hand was in the whole thing. It was the providence of God as it related to that. So God spends, or Joseph spends, the next 13 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. And I think God uses that time to sharpen Joseph. Much like brothers, you and I are to sharpen one another. God takes Joseph and he begins to chisel on him. He begins to make a man out of him. And you know how, just like it was with Moses, I mean, he had that 40 years of prosperity. He had that 40 years in the desert, and he probably wouldn't have had those 40 years of good usage for God if he hadn't had those experiences. And so God needed Joseph to spend some time in the dungeon. You know what? Might be an occasion or time or two when that happens to you and me, where we need to spend some time. Not in the place where we want to be, maybe not in a literal dungeon, but not in ideal circumstances. Maybe not in a town we want to live in. Maybe not in a place we want to be. Maybe we want to hightail it for the church where we're a member. Maybe we don't want to be in the environment, the situation we're in, but God needs us to stay. He needs for us to be there. And while we're there, he makes us better people. He sharpens us and begins us to, we begin to be more useful for God as it relates to that. Maybe those are all stories that we could learn from old Joseph. It's interesting that in this particular case, there's a baker and a cupbearer that come into play here in the story. The baker dies while he's in prison, and Joseph, you know, interprets dreams for both of them, but the cupbearer returns to his old job for the king, and after having Joseph interpret a dream for him, and when the occasion or opportunity for a dream to be interpreted comes up, he remembers Joseph. I admit, 2 years after the fact might be a little bit lengthy after promising somebody you will remember him as soon as you get out of jail. But that's how long Joseph waited. Again, you'd wonder why Joseph wouldn't have been resentful toward that cupbearer. Why would you have me wait here for 2 years? You promised me you would remember me. But there's no sign whatsoever that he was at all resentful toward him at all. And so when Pharaoh has this dream, and after this 2 year period of time, Joseph is called to interpret the dream. And the interpretation leads to great gain for the Pharaoh and the Egyptians as they learn from the dream, as Joseph interprets it, that there's going to be 7 lean years followed 7 years of great harvest. He uses a couple different means of the corn. The bad corn eats up the good corn, and the ugly looking cow eats up the good healthy looking cow, to help him to understand the story and how it's going to apply to him. But Joseph gets the point, and he interprets the dream, and it so impresses Potiphar that he says about him in chapter 41, in verses 40 through 41, can we find such a one, a man as this, in whom the Spirit of God is? How'd you like for somebody to say that about you? Can we find such a one as this man in whom the Spirit of God is? Wow. Faithful man. And he proves this, yes, from the interpretation of the dream, but the fact that he maintained his dignity and his character, his integrity, the whole time he was imprisoned, and imprisoned for a crime that he did not commit. So Joseph is then put over Pharaoh's house, and only Pharaoh, we are told, was greater than he. And so then that takes us to 30 years to death. And as we've already said, and Hebrews 11 tells us, Joseph dies at 110 years of age. So for this period of time, Joseph does a good number of things, not all of which, of course, we'll be able to discuss. But I do think it's important, as we're overviewing this a little bit, that we see that Joseph had the chance during this 80-year period of time, where there's a great deal of prosperity in his life, a reward of God's blessings, and he has classic opportunities to get retribution, doesn't he? I mean, particularly with his family, his brothers. He could have done it with a cupbearer. You know what's interesting to me about Joseph? It's just fascinating to me. You can read all through, you can take in Genesis 39 and continue to read all the way through chapter 50. And you will not find one place, not one time, will you see 1 ounce of complaint by Joseph, either against God or somebody else. He just swallowed hard and took it. And, you know, it doesn't take much at all for us to murmur. I mean, just the littlest thing will cause us to complain. Isn't it true? But not Joseph. At least there's no record of him doing that. He just continues to be faithful, to keep his integrity and serve God. And what a great lesson he is to us. So he's went from being thrown in a pit, being a slave, torn from his family, placed into a foreign land where he's a total stranger, not even knowing the language, you know, forgotten by a cellmate whose restoration to prosperity came as a result of his interpretation, his good works. But not once does he accuse God. Never complains. And not once do we find a situation where his faith is altered by the environment in which he's in. You know, the circumstances of life did not dictate Joseph's faith. He was faithful to God no matter what was going on around about him. We could learn a lot from Joseph. Isn't it interesting that Joseph understood, as it related to him too, that it was all about God? I would implore you, as we look through this and look through some of these passages, and we'll get through this in just a moment, but that as you look at Joseph's life, and he had the platinum card of the day. I mean, he could do anything he wanted to do. He could buy anything he wanted to buy. He was a powerful person. He had a signet ring in chapter 41 and verses 42 and 43 of the king. He basically had all the power a person could possess in the kingdom. Nothing that he could not do. And I want you to see something about him. Look at chapter 41. If you got your Bibles, whatever it is you use to read a Bible nowadays, Genesis chapter 41. And I want you to notice in verse 16, I think I actually have this on the slide. I'm not sure where I put it, but I'm going to see if I can find it real quick. Not there. And I'm getting ahead of myself, but I want you to look at these points here as he's talking about his relationship with God. Joseph got the picture. He understood why it is good things were happening to him in his life. Never blamed God, but gave God all the credit. And things were going right. He says in verse 16 of 41, chapter 41, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. God will give. Verse 28, God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Verse 32, this thing is fixed by God. God will shortly bring it about. Verse 39, Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, and verse 52, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. God, 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 God. The reason why Joseph had the integrity that he had and is the kind of example that he is because he had God in the right perspective. He understood what it meant to be a servant of the Almighty. And so let's make some applications. Have you ever been thrown into a pit? I mean, really, have you ever been in a situation where in your mental way of looking at things or a particular, the happenstance of life, has put you into dire straits and you feel like you're just in a pit and life just stings and the memory of events just sting and you want to forget it. You want to forget those things. And I tell you how you do that. You count your blessings. You stop and you try to turn it around. And Joseph, I think, is the kind of person who gives us an example who saw the good in God no matter how bad things got for him. He continued to serve him and honor him. And the first thing that I want to talk about as we talk about our applications is that if we're going to be the kind of people that we need to be in our relationship with God, that we must never be weakened by our situations. We must learn to stand alone in our resistance of temptations. And I know we need each other. And we do. I've told you many times before, I don't deceive myself at all. I know why God decided and provided for us to have a place like this, this environment, the church, where we could come together and provoke one another love and good works, because without your provoking, I'm not strong enough to make it on my own. I can't do it. God knew that. He understood that we needed each other, to encourage each other, to provoke one another love and good works. But there comes a point in time that we've got to learn to stand on our own. Proverbs chapter 1, and beginning with verse 10 there, that whole situation, we're not going to go and read that, but it's an excellent opportunity. If I was a father, I'd read this particular passage to my children on a regular basis. Because what the wise man does there is he shows us a story. He tells us a story, really. And basically what he says in that particular text is, child, here's what you need to understand. Son, this is what you need to get. That these people, these looters, these robbers, are going to go and they're going to do their looting and their robbing. And they're going to see you by yourself, standing for God. And they're not going to like the fact that you're over there seeing them do wrong while you're doing right. And the only way they can help themselves justify what they're doing is to bring you in to what it is they're doing. And so the writer Solomon there says that they create a net. And like a bird being brought into the net, they pull you in. You young people, listen to me. Those of you that are here old enough to understand, your friends will pull you into a net. They will. They will want you to do wrong because it will give them justification for doing wrong themselves. Can you see that? By dishonoring your parents, you'll give them permission to dishonor theirs. By being somebody who involves themselves in some kind of lustful, sinful situation, you're gonna give them approval for the same. And what I'm suggesting to you is if we don't learn anything else from Joseph, let's learn that we don't need to be people like our 11 brothers. That standing on our own something is we've got to do from time to time. The psalmist would say in chapter 84 and verse 10, I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my Lord than to dwell in the tents of the wickedness. I often sign my notes to you with that passage, have for years. It's one of my favorite passages. Because I serve God because I'd rather do that than anything else. I'd rather do that. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my Lord than to dwell in the tents of the wickedness. I would choose to do that. I would rather do that. I haven't always been that way. At some point in time, you got to come to grips, young people, come to grips with your decision, with your call, with your rather to serve God more than anything else. That's what you want to do. And you'd rather do that than to be involved or exposed in wickedness, and you don't care what your friends do. And when you get to a point like that, it's your faith and your confidence in God. And that's the kind of faith that Joseph had. And that's what he said in Genesis 39 and verse 9. As this woman tried to seduce him and get him to lie with her, he said, I can't do it. He talks about Potiphar. He's not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? How can I do that? And so he stands alone and refuses to do that which this woman wanted him to do. Good looking, well respected, charming, had it all going for him, and Potiphar's wife wanted him. He said no. Proverbs 4 verses 15, 16, in talking about the harlot, the wise men said, avoid it, do not go on it, turn away from it and pass on, for they cannot sleep unless they have done wrong. They are robbed of sleep unless they have made someone stumble. He's talking about the evil there, and he's simply saying, there's just some people that got to get you into what they're doing. They need for you to endorse the wrongdoing that they're doing, and they try to pull you into it. And it's just not young people either. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was involved with people who worked for me that wanted me to go drinking with them so that I could endorse what their own behavior was. And my refusal to not go drinking with them made them uncomfortable. You been there? They want you to be with them. Why? Well, because you're telling them by your being there and joining in with them as a religious person, as a person who's a child of God, that it's okay for them to involve and expose themselves to that kind of behavior. Don't do that. That's the worst thing you can do for God. It's not only hypocrisy. It absolutely is giving people permission to sin. And we need to be careful we don't expose ourselves to that. Avoid it. Do not go on it. Turn away from it and pass on. And then we must learn to stand alone in our temptations, for a day in your courts is better than 1,000 elsewhere, and that's the passage I cited to you earlier. Okay. And here's what I wanted to do. When we must learn to stand our own resistance to temptation. When temptation comes, we must never be weakened by our circumstances or our environment. I already mentioned this. To be sure, your sin will find you out. That's what Numbers 32 says. Don't kid yourself. You expose yourself, involve yourself, in that particular activity, you're going to get found out. You know, you run with dogs, you're going to get fleas, Nancy says. That's just what's going to happen. And every sacred thing, God's going to know about it anyway, is going to be revealed, and you're going to have to answer for that particular activity. And number two, we must not be deceived by persuasion. And what I mean by talking about that as it relates to the particular idea of people trying to entice you and bring you into an activity or into sin that we need to be careful about. And by the way, Proverbs 5 and verse 3 through 4 says, for the lips of forbidden women drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Chapter 6 and verse 24 and 25 says, to preserve you from evil women, from smooth tongue of the adulteress, do not desire her beauty in your heart, and do not let her capture you with her eyelashes. Chapter 7 verse 5, to keep you from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words. telling you, we gotta understand that Joseph's handling of this particular situation gives us the textbook way of handling this, the person of seduction, male or female. Run from it. And understand that if you do get involved in sin, you're not only sinning against the person you're with, but you're sinning against God. Something we gotta try to be trying to avoid. And you're gonna get a situation. Some of you younger people, well, you're in the back seat of a car, front seat of a car. I don't care what car you're in or what seat you're in. You're going to be asked to do something. You're invited in something that's sinful. Participate in that. How are you going to handle it? Make the decision before you get in the car. How are you going to handle it? Who you are? What kind of person you are? Not after you get into that particular situation, because they're going to try to persuade you. They're going to try to involve you into it, because when you do it, you're in that net and you endorse the sin. And you make it okay. You give them permission to go ahead and do the sin as well. And don't be gentle about it. I mean, be people who are not as Joseph was. You run from it and say, I can't do this against God. And you be a person who understands that, you know, you're going to have to give an account of all the things you do in this life. And so you don't be afraid to be passionate about your particular decision. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. And you need to understand you're going to have to bear the consequences for the sin you committed. And then don't be confused by the immediate results. Far too many of us are looking for the easy answer to something. And as I said, it's hard work sometimes to live a Christian life. We make it sometimes, maybe as adults, particularly for young people. We make it sound easier than I think that it is. We're not fair with our young people, with our teenagers particularly. And we need to help them to understand that those decisions need to be thought out and made long before they get into those temptations involved in those particular situations. All right. Then second of all, we must learn to wait on God. I hear from my wife all the time that this is one of her biggest challenges. I'm not sure that, you know, I see that all the time, but she says that it is. And then I hear it from other people as well. And I hear her going around the house sometimes singing, wait on the Lord, you know. Teach me, Lord, to wait. Singing her a song, trying to remind herself. And I just think, frankly, it's not just Nancy's challenge. We all have a challenge with waiting on the Lord. We want it right now. We're not very patient as it related to those things, but Joseph waited 13 years in prison. And he spent a good many years, 2 years later than that, after he interpreted the cupbearer's dream before he actually got called. He waited. He believed that in God, even though things were not easy for him, he continued to serve as God and continued to be faithful in him. And I think that's certainly important. He knew that God was sovereign. God, 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 we talked about as we read about who Joseph was and his relationship with him. And over a period of time, he gains favor with Pharaoh, and he reestablishes a relationship with his brothers, and he was patient. And God delivered for him. And it's a neat story, really. And so Peter would tell us it's this refining is like gold. And you know, 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3. And the process of refining gold is not easy. It's arduous and time-consuming. And that's what goes on not just in Joseph's life, but a good many of the other characters that we studied, including Moses that we've already talked about and Elijah that we're going to talk about in the future. It takes a while sometimes for things to work out. Noah waited for 120 years, as we said, in his particular actions or work. So we need to learn to wait on God. And we already talked about that, these particular ideas here, but we need to learn the importance of grace and leadership. And I added this point, actually the next 2 points, to a couple of these other points from another outline that I'd stolen from somebody else. But this particular point here I think is really important for us. Joseph shows us not only how to be a good prisoner, not only how to be a good servant, but how to be a good leader. And he's a pretty interesting character as it relates to some of the decisions that he makes in Genesis 39 when he talks about how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God, as he was basically the head of the household, he understood his relationship with God mattered a great deal. And here's a interesting thing about this man who becomes a leader. And I'm going to pick on a few people here probably with this. And I don't mean to pick on anybody when I'm preaching, but sometimes we need to learn from these little stories that are being told, and they apply to us. Young people particularly, I want you to see what happens to this guy when he gets out of prison. He's getting ready to go meet somebody of importance. What does the scripture tell us that he does? And they quickly brought him out of the pit after he was called by Pharaoh. And he shaved himself and he changed his clothes. Now, don't minimize that. When you come to meet with the Almighty God, do you shave yourself and change your clothes? Do you realize that there's something important you're about to do? You're about to go worship the King? And maybe it might be a good idea for you to put your Sunday best on. Shave. Clean yourself up. Now, I'm not going to try to define for somebody whether you ought to wear a tie. That's not the point. It doesn't say anything about a tie with Joseph. What it does say is that Joseph, in what might be a hidden passage for some people, that the Holy Spirit saw fit for us to see that Joseph thought it was important for him to do that before he went to see Pharaoh. And I think it's important for us to at least take note of that particular deal. And I think it helped him with his leadership as well. And there's more that could be said about his leadership. I thought about talking a good thing about what happened with his brothers, but I think we all understand that in that particular situation, Joseph used an awful lot of wisdom in things that he did in dealing with the brothers and trying to bring himself back into a relationship with those with whom he had a severed relationship after they came during the famine years and tried to see Joseph in that particular situation, or actually came to get food, and Joseph saw them. Didn't have Benjamin, and he pulls a few tricks, and he makes it available for them to be able to go back and pick up Benjamin and bring him back. And then after a while, Joseph exposed himself for who he is, and the relationship at that point improves, and good things happen in that relationship going forward because of Joseph's forgiving attitude. Took a little while for all that to happen. And then the last thing about Joseph as it relates to him, is that we need to be ready to die. Somebody once said, you know, you really don't begin living until you're ready to die. And, you know, you get in a situation or set of circumstances, and I don't think my brother in the back will mind me mentioning him, where you're dealing with a difficult disease, a challenge, and you come to grips with a good many things. And we should all stop and think for a moment about where we are in our relationship with God and ask ourselves, am I ready to die? Because once you're living your life where you know death is imminent, not around the corner, 24 hours later, if you will, you're going to have yourself in a righteous condition, faithful, the best condition you possibly can be in. But far too many of us give ourselves the latitude of sinning now and getting forgiveness later. You know, procrastination. Being who we want today, and I'll be what God wants me to be tomorrow. And I'm just suggesting to you that Joseph planned his own funeral, if you will. Joseph made plans for his, man, that was a trip for those of us that read the Old Testament about how long and how far Joseph went and the pains that were taken to carry his bones around from place to place. But it was important to Joseph that certain things happened around his particular burial. And because of the respect that people had for him, they saw it to his particular request. It's not so much about making sure that you prepare for somebody to say nice things about your funeral as it is trying to make sure we've lived our life in such a way that people respect us enough to listen and to honor us for those particular requests. So Joseph was ready to die, a man who had his priorities right. You know, as I get ready to close this, The psalmist says in 119:71, it is good for me that I've been afflicted, that I might learn thy statutes. Sometimes the affliction, the pits, you know, the challenges, the purifying process are all things that are valuable to us in our relationship with God. Be it we live 70 or longer, why is it that we can't see that really this period of time we have on the earth is just but a second in comparison to eternity? And as good a time as you're having here, why is it we can't see that the real glory is being sitting around the throne of God where the sea no longer separates us from the throne? And there we sit with the likes of Jacob and Joseph and Moses and Paul and Ruth and Naomi and Esther and all of these great people of the Bible that we're having a chance to study with, and we sit there together holding hands and singing praises unto God. See yourself there. That's the idea that I'm trying to convey. And all the affliction will mean nothing to you. The challenges and difficulties you're going through will matter little at all. Job said, but he that knoweth the way that I take, when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 22 is a passage we already talked about in 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7, one I referred to. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while. If necessary, you've been given or been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. I love this quote. I use it a lot. A.W. Tozier, who's actually a very good religious historian, even a preacher for a period of times. He says it is doubtful that whether God can bless a man greatly until he has hurt him deeply. And if you understand the life of Joseph and you get Moses and what's going on in his life, then you'll come to an understanding of what I think Tozier was trying to say. I'll tell you, I learn a lot from the pleasure I get in life, but I learn a lot more from the pain. And I can think about things that bring tears to my eyes with my family and my friends and even things that have happened here that, as painful as they were, I think they've taught me an awful lot about what I shouldn't be and what I should be. And I just thank God for the latitude that he gives me to allow me to say I'm sorry, that he might forgive me after having made that confession. Joseph is an excellent example for us, a man of integrity, somebody who speaks volume to the idea of the very things that we talked about this morning, faithful man, full of faith, no matter the environment and circumstances that he was in. Good man. We encourage you to come this night if you're not a child of God or a Christian, or if you are a Christian and you've got sin in your life, no matter what that might be, that you'll come forward and let either one of those things be known, that we might be able to help you and puts you in a right relationship with God. Whatever your need might be, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing the invitation song.